In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about PCBs and some other environmental pollutants. And we will try to explain exactly what PCBs are if you don't already know. The long and the short of it is that they're synthetic chemicals and that exposure to them in significant amounts have been associated with a range of human health problems, including cancer. These chemicals aren't produced in this country anymore, but they are out there in the environment, and by their nature, they don't readily break down over time, and so they can stay for long periods of time. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking a little bit about the risks posed by PCBs and also some related chemicals. And we have three guests with us here, all environmental scientists who are all visiting here in Champaign-Urbana to take part in a major international workshop looking at PCBs. It's going on here on the campus of the University of Illinois and is sponsored by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences and also the U.S. EPA. Our guests are Carrie Hornbuckle. She's Associate Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at University of Iowa. Aki Bergman, who's Professor of Environmental Chemistry at the University of Stockholm in Sweden. And Mike Hermanson, he is in the Department of Earth and Environmental Science at University of Pennsylvania. And they're all here, and we're very pleased to have them in the studio. As we talk, of course, questions are welcome, as always. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Well, all thanks for having us.
We should do ask some basic questions here to start with for people who don't have a lot of background in the subject. So I guess the most basic thing to ask is, what are PCBs?
Well, PCBs are industrial chemicals that were produced in the United States between the late 1920s and 1971. They had a large number of industrial applications, but they were used mostly in the electrical industry. And they were used because they are dielectric, that is, that they do not conduct an electrical current, and they are extremely stable, even at very high temperatures, so they could be used in applications that required electrical insulation, and they could be then used in very high temperature applications, mm-hmm. and they wouldn't break down under those circumstances. So they were extremely useful in the electrical industry, and they are largely in the form of oils. Some of them come in the form of very, very heavy oils and can actually be kind of waxy. So there were a variety of different PCB groups that were produced that had very specific applications to certain electrical installations.
So the very properties that made them desirable for those industrial applications, those are also the same properties that make them problematic when you get them out there in the environment, because if you put them in a very harsh environment like an electrical transformer, they'll be very stable, they won't break down, but you then get into the same problem as if it gets out of there into the environment. It still is very stable and won't break down, so they hang around for a long time.
Exactly. And the intent was that PCBs were not supposed to be distributed in the environment. They were not made for that purpose. They were made for use strictly in electrical applications, although in the early going, there were some considerations given to using it in other oils, lubricating oils, and sometimes in wall paint in the early years, but they decided that that was too risky. So they, in general, PCBs were not intended to be distributed in the environment.
Well, I could fill in that it's also PCB was used as sealants in big construction, so you have a more open use of PCBs. And those for buildings constructed during the 50s and 60s, basically. But there's one other application. It's used as heat transfer fluid. And that was a very accidental use, because that caused one of the largest accidents we have ever had. It happened in 1968 in Japan, Fukuoka, where some 2,000 to 3,000 people were intoxicated because it leaked out into the rice oil that was consumed by people having it in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Let me go on to the next question that, as you were saying, they were not intended to be released in the environment. That wasn't supposed to happen, but it has happened. They have gotten into the environment.
Yes.
And it can certainly be a problem in the places where these chemicals have been manufactured. but yes. also more widespread than that. How is it that they ended up getting into the environment?
Well, in the case of manufacturing that I think I can address, they were manufactured at two sites in the United States, in Sauget, Illinois, along the Mississippi River just east of St. Louis was one plant. But the earliest manufacturer was in Anniston, Alabama, and probably the bulk of PCBs produced in the United States were made there. And Anniston is significantly contaminated with PCBs that got into the environment during the manufacturing process. They escaped into the atmosphere because the distillation was conducted at very high temperatures, and those gases were vented into the atmosphere. And then there were some spills in the process of cleaning up distillation residues that got into streams and in soils. And so there were some releases into the environment that were not necessarily deliberate, but were part of the industrial process.
I'd like to add to that, PCBs can now be measured virtually everywhere in the world, not just near the manufacturing plants, but because they were used in such a wide variety of industrial applications and because of their particular properties, they are now global pollutants. And we see them, for example, in the Great Lakes region, they're relatively easy to measure even now, more than 20 years after they're no longer used, in water and sediments and fish and particles in the water.
This is one respect in which people in this part of the country may, if anybody has heard of PCBs, that probably is the concern, that it's in the fish in the lake. And the advice is that people are not supposed to be eating the fish that come out of the lake.
Yes, because of PCBs and other chemicals in fish, people are advised to limit how much fish they eat out of the Great Lakes. It's a shame that we can't fully use this great resource available to us because of these contaminants.
And I think in addition to the place that Mark Hermanson was talking about in Anniston, there's also a place, and I believe that it's in Czechoslovakia, where PCBs were manufactured. And here in the United States, we stopped making them in 1977, but in Europe, they continued to be manufactured for a much longer period of time.
Well, the basic stop was in the early 70s in most of Europe. But what we had was one plant in the Slovak Republic that continued to manufacture PCB until 1985, when the production was ceased. One of the major problems with these with this production was that, well, both in Anniston and in Michalovce, as the name of the town is that in the beginning, no one really knew about the problems with PCB, so there was quite some leakages, and well, they actually put it on landfills and other places. So in Michalovce, there are up to percent concentrations of PCB in some of the creeks. So there is a heavy contamination also among the people living in this area, because they are still eating and catching fish from the waters that are highly PCB contaminated.
Yeah. How was it discovered that PCBs have health impacts and that the exposure to them is problematic and that they're toxic, particularly in large amounts?
Well, I think it became very obvious. The first report on PCB was 1966, and that was from an environment point of view. 1968, we had this dramatic accident in Japan where people got chloracne and health effects, respiratory distress, and a number of health effects. That was very dramatic, so they went to the hospital, and you had, as I said, approximately 2,000 people searching for this.
And this was the one that you talked about earlier, where accidentally the PCB got into the cooking oil that people were using, and then they ate it and they got sick.
Yeah, they did. And this is also showing, well, this sparked a lot of the research that is still ongoing. And what was found out after a couple of years was that actually PCBs are very stable, but one-third of the content in the rice oil was polychlorinated dibenzofurans, more well known as dioxins. So that was the major cause of the acute effects that were seen there.
Oh, and not the PCBs.
Well, the thing is that these are working together, both the PCBs and dioxins. Mm-hmm. And actually there is a third group of quaterphenols that no one really talks about at all today, but they are making up one third of what was in the rice oil.
Yeah. I think a little earlier, Kerry Hornbuckle was talking about the fact that PCBs have become very widespread in the environment. And I think that you could go, I think you can go up in the Arctic and mm-hmm. you can find it in the environment there and in the animals that live there, for example. So if we assembled a random sample, let's say we exclude people who live in Anniston, exclude people who live in the places where the environmental content, the stuff that's out there in the environment is, just take out the ones where it's enormous. Let's just take an average person. Let's go out here in Champaign-Urbana, for example. Okay. And we take a sample of people and we test them. Will we find that they have PCBs in their bodies?
Oh, certainly.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
I think it would not be difficult at all to measure PCBs in any human, certainly in North America and in Europe and Asia. Not a problem.
I haven't heard about one sample that doesn't contain PCBs. Yeah. And it's independent of where you look for it in the world.
So then I guess the question is, at what level does that become a problem? Do you start to find health effects? And what kind of health effects do you see?
I'm not totally comfortable speaking just about the toxicology. But with respect to Great Lakes populations, we do know that people who eat more Great Lakes fish tend to have more incidence of health problems that have been associated with PCBs. Mm-hmm. So it does appear that there's a relationship with the impacts that we would expect, neurotoxicological in particular, and PCBs.
Well, I can talk a little more about it. Actually, there are a number of studies where people that have higher concentration are showing learning difficulties, or that is particularly for the young children. Mm-hmm. And that was, I think there are some 6-7 studies from Europe and from the U.S. showing this. But also we have hearing deficits that have been shown, and that is backed up with experimental work. You have tooth plaques that could be related to exposure to PCBs, and there's a whole range of effects, including cancer.
Yes, and we even heard this morning that PCBs may be considered a triggering mechanism for autism in children, that autism actually is mostly resulting from genetic effects, but it takes some triggers to make these effects pronounced, and it's considered that certain PCBs may have that effect.
Yeah. I'm sure that this is the kind of conversation that people hear and they get alarmed about. Let me ask you this question. If you look at the amounts of PCBs in the environment over time, and you also, if we could do that test, if we could, again, over time, we go out and test people and find out how much PCB is in all of us, what is the trend? Is it going up, going down, staying about the same?
I think, we have real good evidence of declining concentrations. My research group has looked at cores of sediment to look at historical exposures. Like the deeper in the sediment we look, the more PCBs we see until we get back to mud and sediment that was deposited about 30 or 40 years ago, and then we continue to see decreases, and we can date that. So we can see the historical record of increasing concentrations from 1930 to about 1970, and then after 1980, decreasing concentrations in the environment. Concentrations that we see in the environment now are much less than they were 25, 30 years ago, but are not back to background before PCBs were used. So, yes, we definitely know we're exposed to much less PCBs than it used to be.
Yeah, this is the case, and you see that in humans, in wildlife, wherever you go. The Baltic Sea and the area around the Baltic is approximately as contaminated as the Great Lakes was. And we see declining trends both in the humans, as I said, and in the wildlife. But this, the first observation came 1966, and governments acted on this in Sweden 1972. In the U.S., they acted in the early 70s, so that there was a stop to the production, and that's why we do see the decline. It's different with several of the new environmental contaminants that we are talking about today, because they have not been put to a stop yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you what, we have a caller I want to bring into the conversation, and we'll continue talking with our guest, Aki Bergman. He is from University of Stockholm in Sweden, Carrie Hornbuckle from University of Iowa, and Mark Hermanson from University of Pennsylvania. And they are all here to take part in a big international workshop looking at PCBs. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here, and the caller is in Chicago. So let's talk with them. Line number four. Hello.
Hi.
Uh-huh.
PCBs are, I think I heard you say that they are very stable. Is this chemically stable? And if so, if they're so chemically stable, how do they become so poisonous? And one more question, is there no chemical available that can react with them to destroy their danger?
Well, I think I can go on that. they are active as such. The chemical can interact with receptors and molecules in the body, natural molecules in the body, and give a reaction, a health effect in that way. But they are not so stable that they do not degrade. So during the degradation, they form other products that may give other health effects. So it's actually acting two ways. And on the second question, well, since they are so widely distributed, it's impossible to really go in and do anything about them, because they are out there. It's impossible to do anything out there. If you have it in a more local area, it is possible to combust them.
Yes, incineration is one of the more effective ways of destroying the molecule.
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah, sure.
The problem up in the Schenectady, Albany, New York area, the General Electric deposits of, I think it was PCBs, into the Hudson River system. Can you talk about that, and how is that situation going?
Well, I can address it a little bit. It has been a very long-going issue, and there is a GE plant, yes, in the upper reaches of the Hudson River, which released PCBs into the river, which, of course, were washed downstream. What to do with that has been very controversial, because there is one school of thought that thinks that by leaving it there, eventually the PCBs will be covered up with new sediments. But there are others who consider that what is just happening is that it's all being washed downstream and continues to be available. Right now, as I understand it, there is a requirement from EPA that the sediments be dredged, at least in the upper reaches of the Hudson River, where it is most contaminated, to keep more PCBs from washing downstream.
Yeah, that's General Electric has been charged with hundreds of million dollars worth of damages, and they refused to pay it, and it's been held up in the courts for, I don't know, a couple of decades, I guess.
Well, it's typical for environmental lawsuits to be in courts for many, many years. That's not unusual at all, in part because the outcomes are always very expensive, and they want to make sure that they're doing something that is going to be effective.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. I think we have somebody else here. The next would be in Effingham, and that's line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I was wanting to ask, back about 20 years ago, I worked in the Crab Orchard Wildlife area down near Carbondale-Marion area, and I helped to do some of the cleanup of a site down there. Do you know if there's anything available for people who had worked in these areas to be tested to see if they have any of the contaminants in their body that are abnormally high or anything?
I would think the state public health department would be helpful in that regard. I think that's who I would contact first with those kind of questions.
Okay. And someone I think had mentioned a few moments before, I didn't hear all the answers. Are there any symptoms or anything in particular to look for, to be aware of, to watch out for as somebody who may or may not have been exposed?
Well, in general, I would say if a person exposed as a grown-up, it's more of a problem for the for children coming after, and particularly if it's a woman, then it's being transferred from the mother to the growing baby. We do not see so many effects unless there are some very high exposures to the person as a grown-up. We have seen effects in Japan and in Taiwan, but it's very rare that we can actually see anything.
All right, well, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Again, the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also do have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. What at the places that we've talked about, for example, like the town in Czechoslovakia and in Anniston, what sort of cleanup efforts have there been, and what do you literally have to dig up soil and take whatever's there, and if you were going to do it, and has in fact that happened?
Well, I can speak about the Anniston situation. There are several places around the United States, and Anniston isn't the only one, that are PCB contaminated, mm-hmm. because PCBs were used in many, many places, largely, again, as I mentioned earlier, in the electrical industry, and mostly in the production of transformers and capacitors for industrial purposes, very large-scale operations. There are, among these places, various proposals to clean up the known sources of PCBs or to deal with them somehow. And those have ranged from digging up landfills that contain PCBs and incinerating the PCBs in order to destroy the molecule. And that, of course, has been very controversial, and that has been tried in Bloomington, Indiana. That has not gone forward to completion, obviously. In Anniston, the situation is quite a bit different. The issue there was that they had several landfills, two major ones and some smaller ones. But the Environmental Protection Agency in the late 1970s turned over responsibility for dealing with that particular issue to the state of Alabama, and the state regulations didn't require that they dig up these landfills and incinerate the PCBs, which might have been the requirement in some other places. So in part it depends on where you are and what the local and state regulations might be that will lead to some action on cleaning up or removing PCBs. In Anniston, at this point, the effort largely is to clean up residential properties. That's the first effort that's being made right now, as there are a number of them that exceed what EPA refers to as its action level of one part per million of total PCBs. And when you find that amount exceeded in soils on a residential property, then those soils must be removed and replaced with cleaner material, and that's what's going on in Anniston right now.
Mm. In Michalovce in Slovak Republic, I'm sad to say that nothing has really happened in regard of remediation of the site. I hope now, after Slovakia has become members of the European Union, something should be done, because the levels are extremely high in some of the creeks and canals surrounding the original plant. So it's quite easy to go in, and that must be done now, right away. And there's no other way to deal with it than to incinerate the material because it's so very high in PCBs in order to get the levels down on PCBs for the people in general. Unfortunately, after all these years, nothing has been done so far.
Yeah. Is that just a matter of money? I'm sure it's extremely expensive.
It is a very expensive process, and it's hard for communities and local states or provinces to come up with the funds. It seems to me that that governments, or in the case of Europe, more than one government needs to be involved in making the decisions. In the Great Lakes region, well, just in Lake Michigan, for example, there's a number of efforts to remove sediments that are contaminated with PCBs in Manistique and Milwaukee and Green Bay and the Indiana Harbor. There's efforts to either plan to remove PCB-contaminated sediments or have already begun, but it's a very big decision involved in deciding whether we need to spend resources for that effort.
Would we expect, if we went out, say, to our local landfill here, would you expect to find PCBs there?
Well, there will be some PCBs in the landfill, even if it's not an industrial landfill. Just as we would likely find some PCB in everyone's blood here in Urbana-Champaign, we would find PCBs. And there probably are some old electrical components of some kind that might have been used in the household that were discarded along with household waste that would have PCB in them. So,
but it won't be evenly distributed. Definitely see landfills of industrial cities be much more contaminated than cities that didn't have major industrial development but during the time when PCBs were used. I think we could probably predict what kind of landfills would be highly concentrated just based on the industrial activity in the area.
Yeah. There is a law in Sweden that all electric devices has to be recycled. So at the recycling industries, they are every week finding components containing both PCBs and mercury. So if that wasn't the law, it should have been going to landfills or incineration. Yeah. So I'm sure it's all there.
Yeah, it's too bad we're not quite as progressive on these issues as you are in Sweden. We have some other callers here. Maybe just real quick, let me mention the weather item again that I have mentioned a couple times this morning, because we did earlier this morning have some pretty heavy rains over in Piatt County next door to us. And indeed, earlier this morning, about 10 o'clock, the Weather Service issued a flash flood warning for Piatt County, and that will be in effect until 4 o'clock this afternoon. So if you live in a flood-prone area or along creeks and streams, you know, you're especially vulnerable to flooding, and keep that in mind. And particularly, don't try to cross flooded areas either on foot or in a vehicle. So that's in effect until 4 o'clock this afternoon. That rain did move into Champaign County. Last weather radar picture I have now is it's getting to be about 25 minutes old. So at that time, there was some pretty heavy rain in the northern part of Champaign County and was moving to the northeast. So that's, chances are by this time, maybe a lot of that has moved out of here. But we are still looking at the possibility of rain for later today and tonight. So keep aware of what's going on with the weather. You can stay tuned to WILL, the next weather report that we have for you. Next chance to update will be at 12:35 as part of the afternoon magazine. And I believe that Tom Rogers will be sitting in today as host of the program. So that gets underway at noon. We have a couple of callers here, and perhaps also I should reintroduce our guest for this hour of Focus 580. We are talking with Aki Bergman. Am I pronouncing your first name anywhere near right?
It's pretty good.
Aki Bergman, he is professor of environmental chemistry at the University of Stockholm in Sweden. Also Mark Hermanson from the Department of Earth and Environmental Science at University of Pennsylvania. And Carrie Hornbuckle, she is associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at University of Iowa. And all of them are here in Champaign-Urbana for a large workshop. People all over the world here looking at talking about the issue of PCBs. So questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have several people here. We'll go to Bloomington, Illinois next, line number 4. Hello. Is there a caller there? Yes, go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, Bloomington, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Bloomington, Indiana.
I have a question
regarding soil remediation as well as potable water cleanup. You mentioned burning or heating up the PCB soils. But I'm reminded of a controlled study that Paul Stamets, the mycologist, participated in, and he used a particular strain of fungi to break down oil spill off the Pacific coast. Is there any type of select fungi that can work on PCB? First part of my question. And then the second one, is there any kind of Buck Rogers technique to take city tap water, put it through some kind of a gizmo to get it freed of PCB? And I'll take my answer off the phone, and thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Well, I can answer that, I think. Unfortunately, even though there has been a lot of research on this, there isn't a method ready to go today on this matter. We have microorganisms that are able to degrade PCBs to some extent, but normally we do not get all the way. As the concentrations goes down, we still have some PCB left, and also some of the different, I mean, there's a whole variety of molecules that we call PCBs, and some of those will be very resistant also to microorganisms. So unfortunately, it's not a way to go.
With respect to the second part of the question of PCBs in water, I think the caller shouldn't be too concerned about PCBs in drinking water. The normal or the most important exposure that people get for PCBs is through their food, and especially food that's relatively high on the food chain, like fish are. But PCBs in tap water are really not a major concern and shouldn't be worried about in any place I know of.
No, that's right.
Okay, hope that gets at the question. Let's continue. We have someone here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, actually that answered one of my questions about the water, because that's what I'd heard from other experts on PCB here. And I was, let me ask then a couple other questions. I read that last year the World Wildlife Fund did a test on persistent chemicals in the human body last year, and they found a lot of chemicals in British people, and they say that 99% of the people tested had breakdown products of the pesticide DDT, even though it had been banned years ago. And I was wondering, can you say that PCB is as persistent as DDT? Does anyone know yet?
Oh, yes. We always classify DDT and PCBs in the same group of chemicals. They are mentioned in a convention from Stockholm, 2001, the POP convention, it's called. And they are really as persistent as the DDT. Actually, the breakdown product of DDT is the most persistent one that we call DDE.
We have, to follow up on that, we have done some research on DDT in the atmosphere in places where it was used, because it was very heavily used on cotton plants in the United States and also on fruit trees, on apples, pears, and grapes. And even 25 years after its use was discontinued, we find in orchards that produced apples, pears, and grapes that the concentrations in soils and in air are still very high. So they are very, very persistent. And that's largely the DDE, as Oke mentioned.
What is interesting here is to see that DDT was used as a pesticide, and when the ban was put on, it rapidly decreased. So what we see today is that we have approximately 1/10 of the concentration from the 70s in humans today. And if we are doing the comparison with PCB, where you have a lot of different sources, industrial uses, and even if there was a stop, a ban on PCBs in early 70s, they were still in transformers and in buildings and so on. And still are. So we are down to about 1/4 of the concentration from the 70s. So that's a big difference in the uses and use pattern.
Can I ask a further question? That is, somebody mentioned that pregnant women or women who have had more pregnancies tend to have less PCBs, which implies that possibly they're giving it to their children, and someone also mentioned that it's particularly important when we're talking about young kids. And I was wondering, in a lot of the reports out of Europe, when they say PCBs, they call them gender-bending PCBs. And I was curious as to what research has been finished or what you can say about what anybody knows about that particular effect.
Well, I don't know about the human effects of that, but I've done a considerable amount of work with groups who are working in Arctic Norway, and there's a large population of polar bears in this particular place, and they are observing an unusually high incidence of hermaphroditism, if I've pronounced that correctly, in which some polar bears have ambiguous sex organs, which of course has very significant implications on the future of the population. It has been roughly attributed that this is somehow associated with the high concentrations of chlorinated compounds that are found in polar bear tissues, because polar bears are very high on the food chain. They are actually above humans on the food chain. And so they are accumulating very high concentrations of these chemicals, and nobody knows exactly where this gender problem is coming from, but it is thought to be perhaps associated with the high concentrations of organic chlorinated compounds that are observed. And yes, it is true that mother female polar bears who give birth do have lower concentrations of chlorinated organic compounds because they are transferring some of that to offspring during birth.
We know a lot about the transfer, both during pregnancy and breastfeeding via the mother's milk, because this is a pathway of excretion via the milk. So we can actually see a lowering of the PCB levels in mothers with several children. On the other hand, what you see is that the concentrations has decreased so much of the PCB today that there's no reason not to recommend breastfeeding. That's the conclusion we have. But it's important that women are thinking about what they are eating also before they are getting pregnant. And then I'm talking about females in reproductive age actually should be careful with fatty fish content from the Great Lakes, for example.
I have one other question, and that is, a quick comment is, isn't it about high time somebody does research on human beings instead of relying on polar bear studies? But I wanted to quickly ask you before I get off here is, I read an article recently about polybrominated diphenyl ethers, and I imagine that's a similar class of chemical. And it says that U.S. News and World Report said that the United States concentration was 60 times the level that it is in Europe in humans. And I'm most curious if you knew much about that. And it's a anti-fire. It's a
flame retardant.
Yeah. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you asked a question because I know that's something Professor Bergen is really interested in.
You are very well educated. I must say you are exactly right. The levels in North America, both in the U.S. and Canada, are sky high, I would say. And actually, there is a proportion of the U.S. Canadian population that have higher PBDE levels than PCBs. So this is, I wouldn't call it an emerging issue because it has been emerging ever since 1981, but not until around 1999 or 2000 that started to become an issue in the United States. And I've been working with this for 15 years approximately in Stockholm, and it's basically 5 years of research here. Yeah, the levels are very high. The legislation is very poor. There are some voluntary decisions taken at one of the big manufacturers. This is one of the real major concern I have for the future. And I just want to add to your first question there that we are doing a lot of research on humans, and I've been involved in an epidemiological study in the Slovak Republic where we do see a large number of effects among those that we are looking at. So there is a great literature out there.
Yes,
glad for your question.
In the Great Lakes region, too, there's been quite a bit of work looking at possible effects on humans. Of course, we can't do laboratory studies on humans, and so the studies are, many of them are more indirect than in looking at direct effects.
Mm. Well, I'm glad we got in this area. I want to make sure that we talked a little bit about it before we ended up out of time, because here we spent a lot of time talking about PCBs and the fact that they're problematic and they're stable and they stay in the environment for a long time. And there are probably still things around us now that have PCBs in them, but at least we can say that the manufacture of PCBs has stopped. But here now, there are similar chemicals that are being manufactured that are being used now where people have similar kinds of concerns. And I know it gets confusing for people who aren't scientists, but these things are – it's easier to refer to them by their initials. So now we have these things, the PBDEs, which is what Professor Bergman was just talking about, that are used in apparently in a lot of electronic devices, computers and television sets and things like that. And the concern is that these chemicals do off-gas and that they are in the environments all around us. What sort of concerns are there connected with exposures to these things?
Well, they are very similar to to the PCBs. The thing is that if we had an industrial use with PCBs, we have much more of an indoor, both in our homes and at workplaces. We have them, as you said, in computers, but also in textiles. So there is a vast number of sources for this. And what we saw, there was an international workshop last week in Toronto on this, where I come from. We see very high levels of the PBDs in dust, for example, and we know that from electronic dismantling, for example, that we've been measuring, but also that we see these tremendously high, and I must emphasize this, these tremendously high levels in the U.S. population. Mm-hmm. Because since they are up to 60 times, I would say 10 to 60, 70 times, maybe 100 times the European levels. And the actions taken on this side of the Atlantic is pretty poor. I'm very much concerned.
Did you want to add something? Are there good alternatives to these chemicals if that's what you need, if you need to have a flame retardant? Are there other things that we know of that you could use instead that don't have the problematic effects that you have with these? Or does anything in this group of chemicals, are they all similar enough so that you would expect that you're going to see the same problem? And just making a little change and having something different is not going to make very much difference.
Well, first, we are using a lot of flame retardants, and about 15% of all flame retardants are brominated. And among the brominated compounds, we do see that certain of the flame retardants are the real bad ones. Mm-hmm. And these are the ones that are bioaccumulating, that are increasing in the food web. So we get these high concentration at high level, trophic level. And those are the ones we can act on. And also there are alternatives. There are phosphate compounds that seem to be less dangerous to use. So there are chances to replace them. Also, it's possible to do something with the technique, how the goods are actually manufactured and what they look like, so to say. So there are ways to deal with this. And in Europe, I think one of the reasons is that we have left the brominated compounds more on a voluntary basis. The industry very early saw that these are going to be bad chemicals, so they substituted the chemicals. You should know that approximately 50% of the world production goes to North America. Mm. And it's very high amounts of the chemicals.
actually exceeding the volumes that we ever produced PCB in. So it's just the brominated diphenylates, PBDEs, are between 70 and 80,000 tons per year. And half of that's in the U.S.
So you say that the European manufacturers largely have they anticipated the fact that maybe it was going to be a problem. They weren't good chemicals, so they said to themselves, the government didn't come along and say, you can't use this. So they said to themselves, maybe it'd be a good idea for us to think about using something else. Are the alternatives more expensive?
Well, I'm not sure I can answer that question, but there are definitely alternatives. And what I've heard is that some of them are more expensive. But I know one of the big Swedish companies, IKEA, they went bromine-free in 1998. So nothing what is manufactured from there is containing brominated flame retardants. And they still meet the criteria in California and U.S., U.K. and all of the world. So there are ways to solve the problem. Yes, but we have a number of other chemicals around, and I'm sure Kerry can talk about fluorine and fluorinated compounds also. So.
Yeah, we've just like the flame retardants, there's a lot of chemicals that we add to our life simply as kind of a new additive to prevent to voluntarily prevent action. Like, for example, fluorinated organic compounds are used to prevent water penetration or to protect carpets from stains. And these chemicals have been measured in blood of people worldwide, and we've measured them in the water and fish of the Great Lakes. Similarly, synthetic fragrances that we add to our detergents, our shampoos, and our deodorants most widely used are not biodegradable, and we easily measure them in humans and in water of natural systems.
Yeah. Well, there's questions about health effects of these things individually. There's even bigger, more difficult questions about health effects when you combine them. You might say, if you give a person a small amount of any of these things, you might say, well, it's not a big problem. But then there's this question about, what if you give them a small amount of this one and a small amount of this one and a small amount of this one? You know, what the additive effects are. Do you think that how are we doing in the United States, for example, in terms of thinking about this and maybe developing some policy on this?
Well, in general, we don't know very much about the synergistic effects of chemicals at all. Just knowing their individual effects requires a level of study that is very sophisticated and very involved. So it's not very often that we have the opportunity or the resources to study the synergies of the variety of compounds that people are exposed to. But you are exactly right. And it's not just the organic compounds when you get to that point, but there are a large number of inorganic compounds and trace elements as well that are potentially very dangerous.
Yeah. Well, just specifically, if we talk about the PBDEs, mm-hmm. the compounds that Professor Bergman was talking about a little bit earlier, is this something that here in the United States people are starting to talk about? I mean, is there a movement afoot to saying, look, this is really a problem?
And we gotta do something about it? Environmental scientists are recognizing both the prevalence of these chemicals in our environment and in our bodies, but also, and perhaps more importantly, the likelihood of important toxicological impacts of these particular class of chemicals. Because we know so much about dioxins and PCBs now, we're much better at interpreting how similar chemicals will behave adversely in animals and humans.
Mm-hmm. I think with the PBDEs, we see quite similar effects toxicologically as the PCBs, and from a world perspective, and the U.S. in particular, I regret to see that environmental issues are not a big issue in this country anymore. It used to be, and it really needs much more effort. I'm growing older, and I really want to see a better world for the future generations, and we are definitely not on that track right now.
Anything you'd like to add before we finish up?
Well, I completely agree with Aki's last statement that we seem to be flooding our environment with chemicals that maybe we don't need to be putting there and injuring our future generations for many years to come. And I think we should be more cautious and aware of the dangers associated with these decisions.
Yes. Okay. Yes, I agree as well, because there's a chance that we could be making some of the same mistakes that we have made in the past with DDT and PCBs.
One final would be that didn't we learn anything from PCB and DDT stories? Didn't we do that?
Yeah. Well, we will leave it at that with our thanks very much to Åke Bergman from University of Stockholm in Sweden, Kerry Hornbuckle from University of Iowa, and Mark Hermanson from University of Pennsylvania. Thank you all very much for being here.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.